first thing that asked me, when is there anyone who's not on the email list who wants to be on it? Okay, so put your email address on here. And speaking for us this week is Jennifer Mann.
Thank you. Mic working?
Yep.
Yes? Okay. All right. So I'm probably going to be one of the more unusual talks that you hear, hopefully, this semester. And I have a former student in the audience and a current student in the audience, as far as I can tell. Okay. So I picked this topic, or this title, Top Isomerase Notenlosterin, for a couple of reasons, and we'll hear about those, I guess, as we get into the talk. But I'm just going to give you an overview today of some topological problems out there in the world of biomedical mathematics.
I have a question about the title.
Sure.
Why is topoisomerase female?
A little bias on my part. Yes. No, we don't know for sure. Okay. So is German your language you're studying, or you just happen? You just speak German. Okay. So German is what I studied as an undergrad, based on family ancestry. Okay, but first, knots are pretty. They're all around us. They're interesting from an artistic perspective as well as a biological and mathematical perspective. They've been used in art, in gardens. Some people train trees to grow in this form. They occur naturally in things on macroscopic level, twigs, but we're also going to see today that they occur microscopically in biological molecules such as DNA, RNA, and even proteins. Okay, but first of all, what do we mean when we say a knot? What is a knot? Anybody have any notions? What's your everyday sense of what a knot is?
Something tangled.
Something tangled, okay. Any other comments, thoughts? All right. So, would this be a knot? Maybe, maybe not.
Is that not supposed to be there on the left? Yeah.
Right now, yes. There may be some discussion of a technical definition, some people are saying. How many vote this is a knot? Pardon?
It's a rope with a knot.
It's a rope with a knot. Okay. Anybody think it's not a knot? One person. What is your thought?
I mean, a knot in the mathematical sense is like an embedding of the circle in the dimensional space.
Beautiful. Next slide. Given to us already. Okay. So, yeah, a mathematical knot has a very formal definition, and it is take a circle in the topological sense. So, in the topological sense, this is a circle, so is this, so is this. Take a circle and embed it somehow in three space, and that's a knot. Okay. So, in math terms, that's a knot. And assuming that what's going on between my hands is a fusing, this is a knot. Okay? And these are all knots. But in this strict mathematical sense, that's not a knot. But when you study knots in other polymers, then you have to sometimes make a little adjustment to this concept or this definition and say, okay, the reason why we're not calling this a mathematical knot is because we imagine that we could push this knot or the end of the knot anyhow through there and we could resolve it without having to break the rope and pass something through and rejoin, right? Okay, but in many biopolymers, that's not going to be possible, such as in DNA and protein. The ends are either so far away or busy with something else that it's not going to be physically possible for that end to do this. So any action on that biological knot is going to happen locally. So for all intents and purposes, you could put a big sphere around this knot right here and capture it here, and anything that happens interesting to that knot is going to happen locally. So even biopolymers that are knotted somewhere down the line, we're going to think of those as not for our purposes, okay? But yes, this is the formal math definition of what a knot is. Take a circle, embed it somehow in three-dimensional space with a few restrictions. We don't allow double points, meaning that we talk about crossings in a very significant way. So when you look at this knot again, these two points right here are two distinct points in three space. It's not as if the knot is occupying one point there. And we can clearly see, if we look at this, that say one strand there is passing over the other strand, okay? And that indeed they're occupying different points in space. But if we take this three-dimensional knot and project it into the plane of our paper or the board or the computer screen, we've somehow got to keep that three-dimensional information in this projection of our knot, because this guy exists in three space where these aren't occupying the same point in space. So you have what are called knot projections or knot diagrams, and this is how they're generally drawn. This truffle knot would be drawn in this manner, where we make a little break in what is the understrand, the agreed-upon understrand, and then we keep this strand solid, and we call that the overstrand. Okay? So mathematical knots exist in three-space, but we often have to project them in two-space to visualize them and record them in tables and such. So we have to add in some of that three-space information to the 2D projection. And so here is a typical table that you might find at the back of a knot theory textbook or on this website prepared by Rob Schrein, who developed the software program KnotPlot, which originally it was his PhD dissertation. It was just a visualization tool, but it has much more functionality to it now. He continues to work on it and owns his own software company. And you can calculate invariance of the knots, and they're just, and he's even added recently in to the knot theory, knot plot software, some functionality that biologists can use to say they can set up which of these configurations might be the input to a biological reaction, and then we can say what are the mathematical possible outputs in one step, and the software can give the biologist some information perhaps about their biomolecules. So that's something neat to just play around with, check out if you're interested in knots at some point, KnotPlot. Okay, so the first and the biomolecule that we'll talk about most today is DNA. So first of all, let's make sure we've got some understanding of what DNA is. What's DNA?
Genetic coding?
Yes?
It's a polymer.
It's a polymer? What does polymer mean to you?
It has repeating building blocks. Which
yes.
Have only four possible.
Okay, and what are those four possible?
Adenine, thymine,
guanine. Okay, so if you remember a little of your biology, yeah, we've got some information about it. It is a biopolymer, which means it's made up of some repeating units. So those are called nucleic acids, and the ones in DNA are the ATCG, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. And two of those pair with two of the others in normal base pairing. We've got A pairs with T and C pairs with G. A and T make two hydrogen bonds with each other. C and G make three. As you start getting base pairs with those different pairings, you get a little twist in the overall molecule. For every base pair you make, you get a little twist. Okay, and so these ropes are very crude but somewhat nice models for DNA in that we have two colors, we can at least see here, twisting about each other in a helical fashion. And that's what happens when you start stacking up base pairs of DNA, okay? And adjoining them along their backbones with the sugar phosphate molecules. So those repeating units, those nucleic acids, are on the interior of the molecule. The exterior of the molecule are the sugar and phosphate. So each nucleic acid has a sugar phosphate, and then the nucleic acids are joined together with bonds along those sugars. So the phosphate molecules are along the outside of the molecule. Okay, so if this rope is myelin DNA, the phosphates are along the outside. And each phosphate has a negative one charge. So overall, this DNA molecule is highly negatively charged along the exterior. What do you know about negative charges when I bring them together? They're going to repel each other. So there's a lot of physics and a lot of geometry going on with the DNA molecule that we need to be aware of when we start trying to study the topology behind it, too. Okay, so there are a lot of forces happening, and a lot of the geometry about the base pair stacking and everything drives the shape of this molecule. Okay, I have a few more slides to illustrate some of this. Okay, and just briefly, what's the central dogma of molecular biology? Well, there's a debate as to which comes first, but we've got DNA that can self-replicate and be transcribed into RNA, and RNA can be translated into proteins. And so at the beginning, when I asked you what DNA was, someone said it's a genetic code. So yes, it contains the information that tells the cell the ingredients, basically, to make proteins through this route of RNA to proteins. So there's a lot going on that we don't necessarily have to know, but just put it in its position, maybe. You've got DNA. It is a biopolymer, can replicate, can be transcribed into RNA and translated into proteins. Okay, where is it? Well, so we said this rope is our model for the double helical DNA. We've talked about how we've got base pairs on the interior of the molecule, and on the exterior we've got the sugar phosphates. Okay, and we mentioned that as you start making base pairs and stacking them together, you get a little twist going on, which forms this double helix. All right, and then this double helix has to be packaged within the nucleus of cells in organisms such as ourselves. So you've got a pretty long, flexible molecule that's got to be packaged in a very, very small space. So there's a lot of different levels of organization. So first of all, you get much of this DNA being wrapped around protein complexes called histones, okay? And so at some point, the DNA starts to look like a bunch of beads on a string, okay? And then those get wrapped up in a structure called a solenoid. Okay. And you've probably seen pictures of chromosomes. If you zoom in on a chromosome, you've got this layer compacting of the DNA. Zoom in even further, you're going to see your basic double helix. But all of that has to go within a nucleus of a eukaryotic cell. So there's a lot happening to the DNA at any given time, and you've got a really long molecule, and you've got to stuff it into a small space, basically. So that presents one problem already. We talked about the components of the DNA, so maybe we won't go into that too much, but again, here you go, an adenine thymine base pair with the two hydrogen bonds and a guanine cytosine with a three, and then you see the basic nucleotide here with the phosphates, which would be along the outside. So the base pairing is going to happen over here between the two bases, and then you've got the phosphates on the outer side. Those are the two, what are called WC, you see there, Watson-Crick base pairs. Those are the normal base pairs. Weird things happen in all situations. So there are other instances of different bases pairing together, but it's under some extreme circumstances. Okay. And they pack up and they form this double helix because you've got two complementary strands both twisting around each other. That's why we call it the double helix. So this quote comes from Neil Osterup, a biologist at Vanderbilt University, and he communicates with a few mathematicians. So he really knows what topology is when he says topology. When you read the literature, you'll see some people say topology when they mean topography or who knows what. But there's a few folks out there that even that are out of our discipline, but when they say topology, they really understand they mean it's more than just the geometry of the DNA. It really is the topology that's important. So he indeed has this quote that I really liked out of his 2008 paper, that topology affects virtually every nucleic acid process that requires the double helix to be opened or moved within the cell. And we're going to talk about some of those processes today, and you'll see that that happens all the time. That DNA, though, when it replicates, you probably remember, the two strands have to be separated, and indeed pieces of DNA are being moved around quite often as well. And topology of the DNA molecule during those interchanges is very crucial. So what are the three basic topological forms of DNA? So remember, you've got the double helix, and that forms, well, a double helix. But then if you introduce twist into that double helix, then watch what happens. Should give it some more. If you introduced enough twist, then it naturally begins to coil about itself yet again. And so this is what is meant when you hear biologists say super coiling. You've already got the double helix, which is one level of coiling, but now that double helix is coiling about itself once again. And so that's what we mean by super coiling. So that's a super coil. And look what happened to that circle we started out with. It got much more compact, didn't it? So supercoiling is a very useful thing for cells in that it begins to compact those long DNA molecules. So that's advantageous. Okay. And then in the middle, of course, you can have knots in a DNA molecule, right? You can have some entanglement that can't be resolved unless we break the DNA somewhere, pass through, religate. Okay. That would be what we mean by a DNA knot. And then you can have what are called catenanes, or we mathematicians would call links. And that is when you have one or more DNA molecule that are somehow entangled together in yet another way that you couldn't resolve this entanglement unless you did break one of them, pass through, and religate. These images we're looking at are actual double-strand DNA molecules. DNA, even under electron microscope, which is what was used to take these images, is very thin, and we really couldn't tell over and under strand information. So the DNA gets coated with a protein, a recce protein, that binds all along the protein all along the DNA molecule. And then imaging with this electron microscope, if you look carefully at the original images of these, you can see which strand goes over and which one's going under at crossings. So we do have techniques to visualize the actual topology of these DNA molecules. And so we can characterize them, whether they're just supercoiled, knotted, or linked together. And we can even visualize exactly which mathematical knot they might be in. Okay, and so supercoiling can occur at many different levels. I'm just showing you more and more twist induces more and more coiling. So this is pretty tight, quite compact compared to the original relaxed molecule over there on the left. Some other things you notice, though, once it gets supercoiled, generally what happens is you have these loops at the end, right? And we'll maybe mention those again. Okay, so we did say this on the picture slide, but again, here's our definition. What do we mean by a DNA knot? We mean a single DNA molecule that's somehow entangled with itself in a manner such that we could not resolve this entanglement unless we did break the DNA somewhere and pass part of it through itself and then religate and release. Okay? And a DNA catenane will mean two or more DNA molecules that are somehow intertwined or intertangled with each other such that they also could not be separated unless you broke one of them. So, how does this happen? We said supercoiling was advantageous, but the knotting and the catenating, as you might expect, is not advantageous for cells. So, what causes it to happen? And then a little bit later, we'll see how is it resolved. As Neil Osterhoff quoted, as that quote from his paper in 2008, topology drives nearly every reaction with DNA within the cell. Well, at any time in which DNA is being separated, either the two strands from each other, or there are times when a single strand of DNA actually gets a double strand break in it momentarily, and then put back together. So any time you have those events happening to DNA, you could potentially form a knot in the DNA. So compacting the DNA alone within the cell, which is the process of supercoiling and packing it up, at the same time that it's being supercoiled, other processes are going on to that very same DNA molecule. Protein machinery is moving down it to try to replicate it and such. And there are times when it for natural reasons it gets broken and religated. So if you've got a highly supercoiled DNA molecule that's already packed within a cell, and maybe in one of those looped-in regions that we saw in that earlier electron micrograph, maybe that's where the breakage event happens. And maybe because it's all packed close into the cell, when you religate it, you might capture a nearby loop of DNA, such as that. And then religate it, and you've got a knot now, okay, in that supercoiled molecule. The topoisomerases, I'm going to tell you what those enzymes are in a moment. Notice their name comes from our fabulous field of topology. Indeed, they are the enzymes responsible for maintaining the appropriate topology of the DNA within cells. But in so doing, the topoisomerases are one of the type of enzymes that do bind to double-stranded DNA, and they make temporary double-stranded breaks in the DNA and allow pieces to pass through, and then they religate it, okay? The type 2 topoisomerases do that. So when they do that, if they anything goes slightly wrong with their breaking and rejoining, they can form catenanes or knots quite readily. Replication's another time when you're separating DNA strands and then putting things back together. So that's a possible time when knotting can occur. And so this first one is similar to the compaction. You've got supercoiled DNA molecules, and the supercoiling alone is a process that requires a lot of twisting of the DNA, literally. And so in the tight areas within cells, you can have two strands colliding and perhaps being rejoined together. And we're going to mainly talk about recombination here in a moment, but transcription. All these processes that involve the DNA involve either separating the two strands or making momentarily breaks in the DNA and putting things back together. And because you've got this long polymer and lots of it crammed in a small space, it's all of these processes are prime times when knots might occur in your DNA. Okay, here's some more electron micrographs of various DNA knots to let us see that there are all types of knots. Now, that knot table we saw from Rob Shrine, we had a whole bunch of knots, I think up to 9 crossings. Well, generally, the knots that you see in most DNA molecules that we're able to study, the DNA molecules themselves are not so long, and of course, their actual length limits the complexity of the knot that could exist in that molecule. So we generally see knots maybe up to 12 crossings in DNA, but more likely up to 7 like this. So you see on the top left, we have a truffle, a 3 crossing knot. And when you're a mathematician studying knots, one of the first things you start doing is observing the knots and just maybe counting things about the knots. That's one way to distinguish knots. How many crossings do they have? And up to mirror image, there's only the 1 3-crossing knot. And then you see a couple of different 5-crossing knots. You see what's labeled as a torus knot and what's labeled as a twist knot. The twist knots are the ones that we just formed when we took this so-called supercoiled DNA molecule and we said, what happens if there's one strand passage event down in this looped region? Then we get what we call a twist knot. Okay, and so since most of the time DNA is hanging out in that highly supercoiled state, twist knots are the ones that we most often see in DNA molecules. But you can have torus knots, and here's another 6 knot, 7 twist, and then here is one that is neither a torus nor a twist, this granny knot there, another 6 crossing knot. You can also, as I mentioned, have catenanes. So on the outer left and right, you see 2 examples of catenated DNA molecules. The one on the left is what mathematicians would call the hop link, and this one on the right is an example of the whitehead link. You can see the one DNA molecule goes under there, over, under, over, under, over. And then the second component is this circle going through there. And in the center, we've got a 4-crossing knot, the figure 8 knot. So this is just to convince you, yes, indeed, all these things can happen in double-stranded DNA molecules. Here's some more catenanes with much higher crossing number. And you'd have to study the electron micrographs closely, but you can indeed determine over and under crossing information, and therefore characterize the different cat means and knots. Okay, so what happens, though, when you have knots in DNA? So this is some of the research that I did at Baylor College of Medicine before coming here. What are the consequences of knotting in DNA? And we found that it inhibits gene function in two ways. It both blocks replication through the DNA molecule that's knotted, and it is blocking transcription as well along that DNA molecule. So suppose, this is a knot, yeah. Suppose that somewhere within this knot, in this region over here, let's say, there is an essential gene. Let me do my fusing so I don't have as much to hold, perhaps. Okay, so suppose that's fused together nicely, not with just my hair clip. And that suppose in this region in the DNA, there's a gene that encodes something that's essential. What might be essential? Well, let's suppose that this is an E. coli, this DNA is an E. coli strain, and right along here we've encoded for a particular antibiotic resistance. And so we're going to grow up our E. coli in the presence of that antibiotic. If they survive, they must have been able to keep replicating this DNA and keep this gene, and also they must have been able to transcribe this region of DNA and make that protein that confers the antibiotic resistance. If they die, something went wrong in that process, and we've got a few experimental techniques to figure out what went wrong. So we found that when we induce knotting in DNA substrate that carried an essential gene, that the gene's function was being inhibited, both by replication being blocked and transcription. So replication is when you're trying to replicate this DNA molecule and pass on copies of it to daughter cells. Transcription is when protein machinery is trying to move along the DNA and transcribe. Well, first make RNA and then make proteins from them. And additionally, if that DNA in this region over here, beyond the knot, contains a gene that's necessary for life, such as it's an antibiotic-resistant gene, we're growing our organism up in the presence of that antibiotic, we found that when we induced knotting, the cells died. So it can be lethal. Knotting can be lethal, not resolved. Next, we have some experimental techniques combined with a good bit of statistics to determine at what rate are mutations occurring in the strains where knotting is happening. And we found that mutation was occurring at a much higher rate in the strains where we induced knotting versus the ones where we did not induce knotting. And when we actually then excised the DNA from those cells and looked at the DNA itself, it was rearranged in the strains that did survive. The DNA was rearranged. So what's happening? Well, just as in the fishing line suggests, when you have a knot in fishing line, and if you've got a fish on the other end and you're pulling on the pole, what's going to happen? It's going to probably stop at a certain point because of the knot. What else might happen?
The line might break.
The DNA might break. Now, if DNA breaks in a cell because the knot did get pulled tight, what would have pulled the knot tight? Lots of things. There's proteins trying to move along the DNA, either to replicate it, they're pulling the two strands apart, and when that gets through here, that's going to push against that, or it could be the transcription machinery moving along, okay, trying to read the gene encoded in that region. There's a lot of proteins moving along the DNA, and they can be the force that pulls it tight. So the knot in the DNA could get pulled tight. If it goes pulled tight, it may just stall things, or it may break the DNA. Now, when you get a break in DNA, that's a crucial event for cells, right? It's a do-or-die event. Fix it or you're going to die. If the break stays in there, the cell's going to die. So there are various repair mechanisms within cells that they find free ends. Some of them grab that and try to join it to something that looks like it would fit with, okay? That rejoining, that repair, may put it back together in the wrong order. And that's what we saw happening most of the time. As well, there are some mechanisms that come along and just say, okay, we give up, and they eat up this DNA if it's got a free end. Because another possible DNA that with a free end is DNA from an invading organism. But So some DNA repair mechanisms, when the knot breaks the DNA, we're apparently rearranging the DNA, trying to put it back together, but in a different fashion. And that did have consequences on the genes. So, open question, big question, not really meant to say we have know anything about this yet, but maybe knots are promoting evolution. They're certainly rearranging the DNA through our own repair mechanisms. This is a more interesting question. Do knots account for the genomic instability that's often associated with chemotherapy? What we have seen is that when children have been treated for childhood cancers much later in life, or at different times later in life, they may have a secondary cancer. The cancer is unrelated from the childhood one, yet cancer is something's gone wrong in your DNA, basically, right? So subjecting them to the chemotherapy to treat the original childhood cancer, what happens when you treat with the chemotherapy and many other anti-cancer medications? They often target the topoisomerases, these enzymes that are trying to control the DNA knotting and catenanine. And they target them and prevent them from resolving such things. So it could as well be that knot remained in the DNA from the natural topoisomerase action being interrupted back for the original treatment, and the knot may have indeed made the genome unstable because it may have led to breaks. Repairs may have been attempted by your own DNA repair mechanisms, but they could have put things back together basically in the wrong order. Okay, and then I also mentioned knots arise during replication, so we're going to see a little evidence of that now. Okay, and here's the famous quote from the 1953 Watson and Crick paper about the structure of DNA. Indeed, at that time, they said that since the two chains in their model are intertwined, it must be essential that they untwist if they are going to separate. So, as we've talked about, the two complementary strands are entwined about each other in this double helix. If you're going to replicate this overall molecule, the first step is you need to untwist those two strands. And they said, although it is difficult at the moment to see how these processes occur without everything getting tangled, we do not feel that this objection is insuperable. So there must be some mechanism to overcome that. And now we know that those are those enzymes, those topoisomerase enzymes. Okay, so here's what happens when you start separating the two strands of DNA to replicate them. So here's on the left side is the original DNA molecule, and you've got to come in and separate or break apart those hydrogen bonds, and then you start making, so the blue is the original, the red are the new strands. You make a new complementary strand to each of those, and you just continue that process, pulling in nucleic acids as needed. So you're separating the original strands. You're literally ripping apart those hydrogen bonds. Now, those two original strands were twisted around each other.
When you start separating them, breaking them apart, you're going to have some buildup supercoils ahead of this replication fork. Indeed, you're going to have this negative supercoil molecule, but when you rip apart the strands, positive supercoils will build up ahead of the replication fork. And then you start, so blue is there, is blue still original here? Yes. And so the red one is the new strand that you have made. And you're going to just translate those coils into the positive supercoils into your new molecule that you form. That's eventually going to be a problem. So some organisms have DNA. Their genome is a circular piece of DNA. Not us, but many organisms. And so let's suppose that we're looking at this in a supercoiled molecule, glucose circular molecule. All right, as you breathe apart these two strands, purple and white, and then start making a copy of each of them, you're going to have those coils building up, and they indeed form some knots then when you get all the way around. Okay? And they partially around. So these are some molecules in which it's different stages of partial replication around the molecule. And zooming in on certain areas, you can see that you ended up with some knotted areas locally there, not up to 6 crossings in this bottom line. And that one's the figure 8 at the top or right. Okay, here's a zoomed in image of that one. So we can see the big replication bubble. So here's the replication bubble, this whole area here. So this is the unreplicated piece at one end, and here's the unreplicated piece at the other end. So this is that bubble that from the cartoon before. But within that, those corals that built up, as you replicated each of these 2 strands, you ended up with a knot locally there that is the 4 crops in figure 8. So here's another cartoon trying to more readily identify what's going on in each stage. So you start out with one supercoiled DNA molecule. You breathe or separate the 2 strands. You begin to replicate them. You get those coils building up. And what is needed is topoisomerase to come in there and resolve those to prevent what we might call knots or precatenanes. They give it the term precatenanes because it's before you complete a replication. And with the presence of the topoisomerase, they won't actually be catenanes. The topoisomerase will come in, act on those crossings, resolve them before replication is complete. Knots also arise during DNA recombination. And this system has existed in nature forever. But within the lab, we have taken advantage of it. If we want to study knots in DNA, we've used DNA replication, a natural process, to generate a lot of DNA knots so that we have substrates to study. So recombinases are enzymes as well, and they cut 2 segments of DNA, usually different places along the DNA molecule. So let's say here's a DNA molecule, and these 2 arrows are representing the active sites for the recombinase. The recombinase is going to come to each of these sites and cleave in the center of each of those, okay? And it remains bound to the DNA. And it twists the DNA around and puts things back together, but notice in a new fashion, okay? Recombinases can either act on sites that are called inverted orientation. Notice that DNA, something we didn't really point out on the sugar phosphate slide, was that there is a direction to a DNA molecule. The sugars, or the carbons in the sugar are numbered, and you talk about 3' 5' direction to the molecule. So there is an orientation in each DNA strand that's imposed by the chemicals, structure of the DNA. So biologically, we can talk about how these 2 segments match it up to each other, inverted or direct. And in one orientation, if you have recombination, you'll get knots. In another, in some loop, you'll get catenanes, as you see in this example. So we can take advantage of this recombination that's already happening in certain organisms and use it to generate other knots or catenanes in molecules that we want to study. I'm not saying a whole lot of details about that. Let's see. Well, just briefly, why this occurs in nature in certain bacteria, for example, such as Salmonella. Salmonella have flagellum for their method of locomotion, okay? Long tail sticks out, okay? They have, within their own genome, the genes to make 2 different varieties of flagellum, okay? And they'll make one type of flagellum and live in their host as long as they can. Now, the host, whether it be us or what, how do we attack these? We form antibodies that actually target the flagellum. So when we start forming antibodies to target the flagellum, they have this little sneaky way of coming in, flipping their DNA, turning it around, and then when their own can use this twisting and recombining of DNA to make other knots. Okay. Okay. And many recombinases are site-specific recombinases, meaning that they bind to certain sequences of ATCG and only to those sequences and cleave only in those areas. So we can do this in a very controlled fashion. And they act on supercoiled DNA molecules as their substrate. So if you've already got a DNA molecule that's supercoiled, you've already got some crossings. They aren't significant topologically yet until we trap them, say, with one of these recombinase events that then traps those original supercoiled crossings into now what are now significant knot crossings. And so this slide shows you the variety of DNA knots and catenanes that we have been able to generate in large quantities for substrates and for various experiments. So I can get knots with a little higher crossing, but these are the ones I can get plentiful quantities of. The triple, and then the five-noded twist and the seven-noded twist, and then I get some composite knots. This is a six-noted composite, and here's an eight-noted composite of the triple and the five twist, even a nine-noted composite. In a particular system, using a hen recombinase. And then a different recombination system that we have using lambda integrase, we're able to get some of those torus knots. We can get the 3, 5, and 7-noted torus knots up to large quantities, and we can get some of the torus catenanes, the 412, 612, 412. And so those are interesting to look at, both biological and topological questions. Another really somewhat more recent project is looking at how small of a DNA molecule can we make that's still supercoiled. Biologists, in studying DNA, are somewhat limited by the length of the DNA. And making the DNA be a viable product to be used maybe as treatment applications later on. The smaller it is quite advantageous. But it has to still be supercoiled to be a substrate for many of the proteins within our body. So this is another hot area of research where you're putting an important gene maybe along this DNA, but you're keeping the DNA as short as possible, but yet still preserving the supercoiling. And then actually, the lab that I left is working with other labs now at Baylor to actually take this DNA and inject it basically as a medication, as a treatment, where you've encoded a necessary gene to overcome some illness along here. And in the lab, they're having some success with cells taking this up and it being replicated and retained by the cells because it's so small and yet so super cool. So, I told you that there is a method within cells to resolve the bad things, the knotting and catenating that can occur. And it is from these enzymes called DNA topoisomerases. And so these are enzymes that have been found in every cell of every organism that's been studied. So they're highly important to all of life. And what do? The type 2 topoisomerases can bind to double-stranded DNA. And the protein makes a break in the backbone of the DNA, but remains temporarily bound to the two free ends of the DNA. And that allows the openings enough such that another segment of the DNA can pass through. And then the last crucial step in these enzymes processes is that they religate the DNA and then release it, go on their way. So if you have topoisomerases in a healthy cell and it is functioning, everything's functioning normally, that's what the topoisomerase will do. They'll bind to double-stranded DNA, make a double-strand break, hold on to the free ends of the DNA, they'll allow part of it to pass through, they'll religate the DNA, and then they'll release. And hopefully, they will have, we've solved knots. Okay? Or if it was catenanes, they would resolve catenanes. They can maintain the proper level of supercoiling by doing that same process. Okay. So that in cells, you'll never see the topoisomerase relaxing all the way. As we saw, there were times when there were positive supercoils that had to be resolved, And then at the end of replication, you've got to put back in negative supercoils. So they maintain the proper level of supercoils. At the end of replication, you can sometimes get catenated to the two newly replicated molecules linked together in some significant way. To separate them appropriately to daughter cells, you've got to resolve this. Topoisomerases, we come in and act one step there and resolve. But again, in cells, these would be supercoils. And then knots, same little manner, they can come in and resolve those. So they're crucial. And they are, the topoisomerase as a protein, it is expressed during replication and recombination. The times it's most needed in the cell is when the cell makes that enzyme. It has plenty of it hanging out to, as soon as these problems arise, to resolve in fully functioning, healthy cells. That's their case. And so here is, so there's still a lot of questions, though, about how the topoisomerase as an enzyme interacts with the DNA and exactly what does it do. There are a lot of stages of the process that I just described: bind, cleave, pass through, religate, release. There's a lot of those stages we understand, but there are lots of the details we don't understand. Where do they bind? I mentioned earlier that the recombinases were site-specific enzymes, that they go to particular sequences, ATCG or something, and bind only and act only at those sites. Topoisomerases as an enzyme, they are not site-specific. There's not a particular sequence of nucleic acids that they look for and bind. So it's not the topology. What we think it is, I mean, it's not the genetic code. It is the topology. That's what we think it is. Okay, and when we look at static images of the enzyme bound to the DNA, one thing we notice is, so this is just a short piece of linear DNA, which is not really its substrate within cells, but this is what we can image. So when we look at a topoisomerase, here's the protein, bound to at least a little piece of DNA, we see that the DNA is bent. Okay, so what happened first? Was the DNA bent and the topoisomerase went and bound at the bend? Or did the DNA bind, I mean, did the enzyme bind and then bend the DNA? Still questions we're not quite sure about, right? But we do know that we can get this static image of what happens after the bend when the enzyme is bound to the DNA, and we see a profound bend in the DNA where it's bound to the enzyme. If a supercoiled, remember, DNA within cells is naturally supercoiled almost all the time. In a supercoiled DNA molecule, when you have a knot, and if it's the twist knot, the type that most often happens in natural DNA, then there is generally not a lot of flexibility within the tight cell and not a lot of flexibility due to that supercoiling. So the crossings that are in the supercoiled region versus the crossings that are in what you might call the clasp in this twist knot probably are going to look different to the enzyme, okay? We know that there's infinitely many mathematical projections of this particular knot. But if it happens, as soon as it happens in the DNA, for just an instant, it probably looks a lot like this. And if the enzymes, the topos, are hanging out right there, they might be able to recognize something that's different about the geometry in this crossing versus the geometry in those crossings. And the geometry is driven by the topology, overall topology of that molecule. So the motivation behind learning more about how they're interacted is that indeed we think the topology is driving local geometry, and then that's what the enzyme is recognizing, knowing where to act. Okay, here's some more images. And this, so that first previous image was a short linear piece of DNA with the enzyme bound to it. Here's a longer circular DNA molecule. And then these little dark blobs, that's the enzyme bound to the DNA. Okay? So one thing you notice right away from these, if that's a substrate, that long circular thing is a substrate for that little bitty enzyme, that enzyme is not going to approach that DNA molecule and move all the way around it and decide where's the best place to act. Is going to have to do it much more efficiently than that, right? So there must be something key about certain crossings that it's recognizing and binding there and acting in those places. And so the title came from this painting. And the title of the painting is not Lustrum. Indeed, means a woman who unties knots. So indeed, I would say that Topoisomerase knots in DNA and convince you, hopefully, that they exist, and when they do, they're bad, but that we have these famous topoisomerases that can resolve them for us. Then we'll look briefly at knots that also exist in some other biopolymers, such as proteins. So when I began my graduate career, they didn't think there were knots in proteins. If they are, they were flukes and they were mistakes and weren't supposed to be there. But now we have found more and more knots in proteins. And we actually find that they have a function. They are holding the protein in a particular state. DNA-protein interactions are all about how things fit together. Okay? The shape of the protein, the shape of the DNA is very important to the interaction and the reaction that's going to occur. So, you may have heard of the protein folding problem. It's still a big question. Given that again, proteins are polymers. They're made up of repeating units. If we know the string of amino acids that form a protein, can we guess what its three-dimensional structure will be? So that is an interesting problem. And how do they fold together? Because they're not made in their folded state. They come out of the transcription machinery as this long, linear, roughly linear, biopolymer, but then they quickly collapse into their folded state. What drives that? How do the particular configurations occur? And why are we seeing knots in some of them? Those are some interesting questions. But again, a protein is one of those biopolymers where the ends are not attached, generally. You've got some string of amino acids, and then they fold up together in some configuration in space. The ends aren't too far from each other, generally, or maybe they are in some proteins. There's a lot of variety, but they are certainly not fused together, okay? So it's not our mathematical knot in that formal definition we gave earlier, but yet again, it's a long polymer, and the interesting stuff about the knot happens quite locally. And so we have to relax and talk about what we call open knots when we're referring to knots in proteins. And when you do simulations of these, you have to somehow say, okay, the two endpoints, we're going to join them together for point of infinity, and then we can do our run our mathematical calculations to determine knot polynomials on this and classify the knots. Okay, so here are the ones that have been found as of 2010. And you see up to a six-crossing knot. And now it's believed that the knots occur within, usually it's fairly deep within the structure of the protein, and that they're stabilizing. So just as they do hold parts of the DNA polymer we've talked about, they hold it close together, where they're doing basically that function in a protein, but it's advantageous to the protein perhaps to stabilize a certain part of the structure. And so you can see the amino acids are numbered, and it's telling you at which point it occurred, and so or which amino acids were involved in forming this number. Some of them it's been somewhat deeply embedded, some it's closer to the end. Okay, so here's some more images of the protein knot. So this is prior to it being all folded, and then when it's folded, there's a lot going on around that knot, and that knot's somewhat at the core. And so how might this happen? And that's another question. How do certain knots occur in certain amino acid strings? How do they fold? So this is another modeling question for mathematicians to help the biochemists out. Proteins have a lot of interesting geometry and topology in their structure, too. They also have coiled regions, regions that are called sheets and such. And knowing the three-dimensional structure of the protein, you need to be able to pull out of that data the significant knot information from just looking at the backbone curve of the protein. And this is that six-legged knot. Let's see. Yeah, that's the six-legged one, which is to date the most complex knot found in the protein. Okay, and then one other biopolymer that indeed has a little bit larger than the protein DNA is the Ebola virus, which I will leave you with this thought as you go off to eat pizza. and so that is an electron micrograph of the actual Ebola virus, and you see an open knot, but nonetheless a knot actually within the bacterium itself. Anybody heard of buzzing microbes? Make a briefly, knots across various biopolymers.
Anybody have any questions?
Yes, sir.
Many times when you show various pictures of knots, they had a plus or a minus in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
So it indicates the sign, and we call the sign of the crossing. If it's right hand, we give it a plus. If it's left hand, we give it a negative. And so let's just recreate that here. So here is basically, here is this crossing, basically. Okay. So imagine that if you grab the over strand, so this is the strand that's going pressing over the yellow, the one I put a yellow arrow is pressing over the one with the broken red arrow. And imagine taking your right hand, this is the easy way to determine. So in grabbing the over strand with your right hand, using your thumb to point along the direction of the orientation. So they have to be oriented strands, which we said DNA had the natural orientation. So you have to orient the knot, and then and it doesn't matter really whether you have a big diagram or not. Just put an arrow on it somewhere and propagate that around. So you've got an orientation already. Grab the overstrand with your right hand, using your thumb to line up with the arrow on that overstrand, and let your fingers curl naturally under that overstrand. If your fingers are in sync with the orientation that's on the understrand, you say it's a right-handed crossing, give it a plus. When you grab the overstrand with your right hand, your fingers curl against the orientation on the understrand, then it's going to be a negative.
Any other questions? Do we determine which way is the proper way to look? It's like this and not this.
So the orientation is just different in these two. And so let's go.
Throw the ends, like, does it have to do with like where the ends are?
It has to do with the orientation on the under and over strand. Let me go back to it. Okay. So let's look at this strand.
Yeah.
Okay. So we can put an orientation on this trephone, and it won't matter whether I put it this way or the other way. We need the same answer. So you might try putting it, draw the same truffle over here to the right, but put your arrow going the other way. Now, once you place an orientation, let's let that propagate around. So when we get to this crossing, we're still heading this way. We're heading this way. So now I have an orientation. Yes. What about the others? Yes.
So we define it looked like that was just kind of arbitrarily.
Well, you weren't seeing the whole knot, so that's why I said let's look at an example. So there's an orientation, and this, whenever this comes back up, it must not do this, for example. We don't see what the rest is doing, but it could do this, come up here and join to there. Okay. It has to be consistent across the whole molecule through orientation.
The initial choice is arbitrary.
Where I put that first arrow? It was. Okay. Let's draw it and put it the other way and see what happens.
Well, they were on the closest.
Wouldn't they? You might be surprised.
No, it's not.
Ah. So it did matter. What mattered was the consistency, indeed. So no matter which way we put that first orientation, this is still the left-handed truffle. Now, if you want to see the right-handed truffle knot, draw a mirror image of it,
right,
which would be doing what?
Changing.
Just changing. So knot theory is best done on the